We are going to be continuing with the lesson that we had started last week as we are examining and asking ourselves the question, how do we go about having a strong church? What defines for us a strong congregation? And it is the intent of these lessons on Sunday evening for the next week or so to just call to memory the things that most of us are already aware of, but in doing so, challenging each one of us to accept the role that we all have within the congregation to do what we can to make it just as strong as possible. As we talked last week, similar to the idea of a chain, the weakest point of a chain is the link that is the weakest. And it is our desire that whatever that weak link might be, we can give it enough support, we can give it enough to strengthen it, that it will help hold us all together. And we began, first of all, by examining the body and recognizing that in understanding when we talk about the body, we recognize that it is basically the idea of the universal church, but we are borrowing from the Apostle Paul's use of the analogy of the body there in 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter. In other passages, it very clearly is the universal church, in Ephesians, the 4th chapter primarily. But in the 12th chapter of 1 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul does go about talking about the local congregation. There he's dealing specifically with the idea of the spiritual gifts and how they are to react to one another and how they are to complement one another. In verse 27 he says, "Now you are the body of Christ and members individually." From the context, he's not telling us that we as a local congregation are the church universal, simply showing us throughout the use of the passages that we have responsibilities within the congregation, and we need to take seriously the responsibilities we have. We talked about that from the perspective of the fact that there are many members within the body, and each of us have varying responsibilities and should consider one another. We spent a great deal of time in the lesson last week talking about the fact that the members have that responsibility of encouraging others to do what they can to fulfill their functions. Now, in doing so, last Sunday evening, the emphasis being very heavy on my responsibility toward you, your responsibility toward me, and to one another, we were only emphasizing then that sense of going and encouraging others that they might do what they are able to do. We ended without getting into a deep discussion of the responsibility that I have as a member of the body, the illustration of the local congregation as a body, and my responsibility in functioning within the body. Paul told the Ephesians there in the 4th chapter, verses 15 and 16, "But speak the truth in love, may grow up in all things into Him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes the growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love." And in doing so, again, we are looking at the responsibility you and I must share with regard to developing the potential within each and every one of us. And it's not sufficient to simply decide that others have particular functions and we take for granted that, yes, I may or may not have certain functions and do nothing to develop them. I think that the local congregation has a responsibility in striving to develop aspects within our lives. We as individuals can encourage one another in aspects of development within our lives. But ultimately, you and I have to come to recognize what are our individual strong points. And what are the areas that we can develop that appear to be weak that can become stronger? The reason I add that last section is that sometimes it's very easy to simply take on the attitude and take on the notion that indeed I recognize what my strong points are, but I fail to recognize that I may also have other areas that are untapped strengths that I can develop within myself. That's where you can help me, and I would pray that I could help you. But it also requires of us then a willingness to listen to each other, that we might see that another, as they're encouraging me, they're not just perhaps criticizing some failings for development, which may come at some point, but they're actually showing me, here's something you can be doing that you may not have thought possible. I think that it's important that we develop among the congregation young men who will one day aspire to be elders within the congregation. That there are young ladies within the congregation that will aspire to be the wives of elders and deacons to help them fulfill the responsibilities. I think we also have among us young men, and I'm not talking now about young men in their 20s, but other men in their 40s and beyond, who need to be focusing on the opportunities that develop within you and can be developing within you to become the pastors of the congregation. It isn't something that simply happens over the course of time as we look out among ourselves and decide all of a sudden, you know, it's time for us to get back to having elders again. Now let's find out who's got the best behaving kids. And once we've found out who has the best behaving kids, let's ordain them as elders. It's much deeper than that. And it requires time in the development. And what we as a congregation need to be doing is looking out among ourselves to these younger men and zeroing in on them and giving them words of encouragement for development. And I would hope that we would also, as the men of the congregation, actually put forth ideas and plans to develop these men who are in their 30s and 40s, many of whom are looking down and now you're looking up again, recognizing that now is the time to prepare for the next few years to reaching the point where you can be ordained as elders among us. So we, as a congregation, need to be looking among ourselves and saying and doing the things that will help them develop. We need to be talking to them privately and encouraging them and not presenting it as some scary role to take, but rather one that is blessed by God, and God expects a congregation to be developing men within the congregation. Now, I recognize that there is no sin to a man who has all the qualifications of an elder to not desire it. There may be reasons that are beyond our knowledge that have for them at this time in their life, or even in the near future, just a lack of desire. But if we as a congregation encourage them, and if some within the congregation who have served as elders in the past, some who are older within the congregation, can sit down and talk to these men and find what they perceive to be weaknesses within themselves, then encourage them in those weaknesses to have strength in those areas that they will prepare themselves to become the pastors of the congregation. I would hope that each and every one of us have within our minds a half dozen or so men in this congregation who perhaps within the next 3 to 5 years could be ordained as elders in the congregation. I think it's a great tragedy many times when a congregation dissolves elderships and then gets used to not having elders. And in fact, kind of gets comfortable not having elders. That's a dangerous mindset, and we must be careful because we can be getting very close time-wise to where we just get comfortable with the men trying to make decisions that elders should be making. We get comfortable with meeting every other month on a Sunday afternoon and making decisions that are almost entirely material and not really dealing with spiritual things that need to be dealt with. So my call to this congregation tonight is, do not be satisfied with the status quo. Do not be satisfied with the fact, and I hope I'm correct in this analysis, we're at peace. Things are going smoothly. We seem to be growing numerically. I would hope we're growing spiritually. But so what? We don't have elders. So do not have the mindset that because things are going smoothly, because we're growing numerically, that it's okay not to have elders. It's not okay if there are men within the congregation, and I believe there are, who can be developing to the point of soon serving us as elders. So I wanted to share that with you. We didn't have time last week because I do put on myself a time limit for the length of sermons. But that was something that I wanted us to explore before moving on and looking at other aspects of what's involved in making for a strong congregation. And now as I quickly review my notes, that was everything I wanted to say. And now we can move on and examine another aspect of what it means to be a strong congregation. One of the descriptive terms that's used in the Bible is the concept of a family. Now, as I did with the body, I recognized with the body that most of the time references to the body are to the universal church. And I also recognize that with regard to the idea of the word family, I don't think, and I've not checked all translations, but I don't think you'll find a clear, distinct passage where the word family is used with regard to the local congregation. But borrowing from a couple of passages that we're going to share in just a moment, I think we can see very clearly that concept exists just as it did with the body in regard to 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter. Over in 1 Timothy, the 3rd chapter, we talked about this morning. In the 15th verse, we have the sense of a household. There it says in verse 15, "But if I am delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth." Let's open our Bible, 1 Timothy, and look at that particular passage and the verses preceding it in a little more detail. The point that I made this morning was on a different matter, but nonetheless, it leads us into the point that I want to make tonight. And that is this. It's my understanding, and I could be mistaken about this, and would be happy to discuss it with any that might want to help me to understand it more clearly, and I say that with sincerity to you. I believe that when you come to 1 Corinthians, the 2nd chapter, and start in that 2nd chapter, he says, "Therefore I exhort all that supplication, prayers, intercession, giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and all who are in authority, that they may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. The Apostle Paul is giving instruction to Timothy, and the instruction is about the conduct that takes place within a congregation. And he continues on, as he says in verse 8, I desire therefore that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting, in like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with all work, with good works. Let a woman learn in silence and be in submission, for I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over a man, but to be in silence. For Adam was formed first, and then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. This is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. Now, see, men have put the transition with the chapter 3 here, but the flow of thought continues about what the local congregation is to be doing and what Paul is telling Timothy to be instructing them in. And that is the preparation for elders. In fact, Paul tells Titus that that's why he left him in Crete, that he might set in order the things that are wanting, which was to ordain elders in every church. Here he just jumps right into it and gives the qualifications in the next few verses until we come to verse 7. And here he switches to remind them, moreover, he must be of good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach and a snare of the devil. Now what? Likewise, deacons must be reverent, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy for money, holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. But let these also first be tested, then let them serve as deacons, being found blameless. So Paul says, teach congregations to develop those who can serve as pastors, elders, if you will. And teach men within the congregation to reach a point where they can serve effectively as deacons to take care of the things that will allow elders to take care of the spiritual things. Likewise, their wives must be reverent, not slanderous, temperate, faithful in all things. Let deacons be the husband of one wife, ruling their children and their own house well. He concludes then in verse 13, for those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a good standing and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. Now note, these things I write to you, though I hope to come to you shortly. And now the verse that I used tonight, and again I had this morning. But if I am delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. And that's what makes me think that in chapters 2 and 3, Paul has laid the groundwork with regard to the local congregation and their interaction. And here we have that sense of family. Though the word family is not used, the idea of household is used. He says, and without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, testified in the spirit, seen by angels, preached among the Gentiles, received up in the world, believed on in the world, and received up in glory. A reference there specifically to Jesus Christ as he brings to an end, in my judgment, what he was giving instruction to Timothy about. So we have, I believe, a clear instruction and illustration here about the idea, the sense of family and interaction as family. He goes on in the fifth chapter of this same book and says in verses 1 and 2, do not rebuke an older man, notice, but exhort him as a father, younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters with all purity. He uses the terminology of family because I think he is, by inspiration, wanting the local congregation to view itself in the close bond of brotherhood, in the close bond of family. And what do we gather from the idea of a properly balanced family? We get the idea of those who are concerned for one another, those who care about one another, and those who love one another and show that love for one another. These three things certainly don't make up all of what's involved in the interactions of a well-balanced family, but I think no one would dispute they are at the core of what a good family is all about. And I think that's what we're called upon to do. We're called upon to be that kind of family that so cares about one another, so is concerned about one another, and has a love for one another. Paul told the Philippians a number of things. But he also told the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians, the 4th chapter, verses 9 and 10, "But concerning brotherly love, you have no need that I should write to you. For you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. And indeed you do so toward all the brethren who are in all Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, that you increase more and more." And in the second epistle to the Thessalonians, in the first chapter, verse 3, "We are bound to thank God always for you, brethren, as it is fitting, because your faith grows exceedingly, and the love of every one of you all abounds toward each other." The sense then here is that we are family, and we are to view ourselves in that regard. There is a willingness then to get to know one another. That's what allows the concern to develop. If we don't get to know each other, there's no way we can be properly concerned about one another. And I recognize, and you've heard me say this before, I recognize that even a congregation of this size is not going to be of such a size where realistically we are going to have as much intimate knowledge about everyone within the congregation. And I say that on a positive note. But it does call upon us, just as among our siblings, we might find ourselves closer to one of our siblings than some of the others. It calls upon us to get to know one another as much as possible. And with some, we might develop a deeper relationship. Not that we're treating others in a standoffish way, but there are things that can simply draw us to commonality and therefore have deeper interests. In doing so, however, we're able then to know and have concerns for one another. In drawing closer together, we're able to understand the cares that others are bearing about what's going on within their lives. We reach a point where there are individuals in the congregation where we feel that we can confide in them, because while we know everybody cares about us, there are some that we're just more comfortable in showing and talking about things that are burdening our hearts in particular. It's because we've developed the relationships that run deeper than simply coming to church on Sunday and staying a little afterwards, coming on Sunday night and staying longer afterwards, or Wednesday night and staying longer afterwards. It's the idea that we take the time to get to know one another so that we may know what are the cares and burdens that others are dealing with. I would hope that when we think about this matter of cares, that you would accept another challenge, a second challenge, to go along with the challenge from last week about getting to know each other. Tomorrow, believe it or not, now don't get too excited, the directory is going to the printer. I wasn't about to announce the printer, the directory's here, but it's going to the printer. When it comes back, let me challenge you, as families, as husbands and wives, take a week and take the first couple of people in the directory and go to God in prayer about them. You may not know much about them, and everybody's trying to run through their minds, okay, who's at the first of our directory, and go right down the line. So a couple of you are going to get a lot of prayers at first. But eventually you'll get down to the S's and the rest of us, the Williamses. But as a family, take time to pray about them. And then next week, take another two or three and pray about them. And over the next few weeks, go to God in prayer on behalf of every family in this congregation. Spend an entire week lifting two or three, maybe four families up in prayer to God when you and your spouse or you and your entire family have a time of prayer. I think in doing so, what we will naturally do is just develop a greater sense of love for one another. And what I think it will also do is lead to getting to know those we've not known well. And that was part of last week's challenge. When we start praying for people by name, we're just naturally going to want to know how they're doing. And it won't be to be prying into other people's lives, but simply the Christian love that we have for them that is expressed in wanting to know how things are within their lives. And in doing so, we have that sense of family. We have that sense of getting to know one another. We have that idea of taking advantage of time to be together with one another. It may simply be to go someplace and share a Frosty. It may be to go to Cracker Barrel and have a cup of soup. It may be to do this, that, or the other thing. It may be to go out and enjoy some pleasurable aspect of nature, as a group will do in a couple of weeks, canoeing once again, or kayaking. These are things that we do that will help develop a sense of relationship and caring about each other. So I hope that you'll take the time and take advantage of the time. And in doing so, as we close this evening, we as a congregation will grow stronger together because we will be viewing ourselves as the body and as the family of God here at Highway 157. And therefore, I would hope that over the coming weeks and months and years, and let me just say, I am by no means suggesting that I'm presenting anything new to you, but I'm just trying to refresh within us that need to be caring and loving and concerned about each other. We're about to sing a song of encouragement. You know what Paul wrote to the Ephesians there in the second chapter in verse 8? He said, "For by grace you are saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God." That's what God did for us. God sent His Son to die on the cross for our sins. And now what are we to do? We're to respond to that sacrifice by putting on Christ in baptism. If there's any in the audience this evening that...